been a long and a tedious and frustrating cold case investigation, and the evidence is spanning over 26 years.
A king salmon man is in custody for a cold case double murder. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Seward Fire Department continues searching for the missing Mount Marathon runner.
This is the longest search that we've had on Mount Marathon, period. Usually, we get people down 5-6 hours.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
One of Shell's drill ships has arrived in Unalaska, and the other is expected by the end of the week. The Noble Discoverer pulled into port on Saturday, accompanied by a small flotilla of support vessels. While the ships were originally scheduled to bypass Unalaska on their way to the Arctic, persistent sea ice could keep them around for a while. Here's Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith.
We obviously are watching the ice very closely because it has so far delayed our entry into both theaters. We couldn't legally be on site until July 15th, but it looks now like we'll probably be on site and start drilling sometime in the first week of August. And that's disappointing because that's time, of course, that we will not get back. But we will make the most of the time that we do have.
Shell is planning to drill 5 exploratory wells in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas this summer. Smith says each well will likely take between 30 and 40 days, taking into account a scheduled 2-week recess in late August for the annual bowhead whale hunt. That means the company will have about a month and a half window to drill in the Chukchi Sea and 2.5-month window in the Beaufort. That is, if Shell receives its final permits and Coast Guard certification of its oil containment barge. If and when the ships do get underway, the Noble Discoverer will be headed to the Chukchi, while the Kulik will be headed to the Beaufort. The Seward Chamber of Commerce is considering ways to make the Mount Marathon race safer in the wake of 2 tragedies during this year's July 4th race. Over the weekend, the state troopers suspended the search for missing runner Michael Lemaitre. He was last seen near the top of the race course, and well-known mountain runner Matt Kenny remains in an induced coma because of brain swelling at an Anchorage hospital after taking a bad fall near the end of the race. Cindy Clock is executive director of the Seward Chamber of Commerce, which hosts the race. She says the chamber is not considering canceling Mount Marathon.
This was the 85th running of the race. So it's a very historic, solid race. Of course, whenever anything happens, I mean, people are going to say, well, what could we do to prevent that?
Clock says runners have suffered broken bones and heat exhaustion in the past, and the 2 incidents during this year's race are by far the worst in Mount Marathon's long history. She has been fielding suggestions over the past several days about how to make the race safer, including turning around runners who don't make good time to the halfway mark and having volunteers sweep the course.
I'm sure there will be lots of ideas discussed at future committee meetings. Just because we all love this race and we just don't want to see anything like this ever happen to anybody again.
While the state troopers have stopped looking for Lemaitre, the Seward Fire Department is continuing the search. Fire Chief Dave Squires says 17 people were on the mountain today. He says all of his theories on what might have happened to Lemaitre have been blown out of the water.
This is the longest search that we've had on Mount Marathon. Period, whether it be a racer or a recreational hiker. Usually, we get people down 5-6 hours.
Doctors are hoping to bring injured runner Matt Kenny out of his induced coma in a few days to begin assessing the extent of his brain injury. Kenny also suffered from other injuries, including a compound fracture to his right leg. Brad Prokoski is a close friend of Kenny's and a spokesman for his family.
We've been reassured that Matt's a young man. He's a very fit and healthy man, and he's got a lot going for him. So, you know, it's very hard to sit back and wait and know that you can't make something happen the way you want it to. But, you know, it's a good exercise in faith and hope.
Kenny was injured in an especially tricky section of the course that has competitors descending a wet, steep rock face. Prokoski says Kenny was very familiar with the course and was running the race for the eighth time. Prokoski himself is a 20-time Mount Marathon finisher and 6-time champion, and he is adamant that the Mount Marathon course shouldn't change.
Because of its higher levels of technicality and its toughness is what draws us to it. You know, things happen. And it's unfortunate, but we know the risks, and we go up there, you know, because we cherish the exhilaration that comes out of being up there.
Kenny has medical insurance, but with uncovered expenses mounting, the family has set up a Wells Fargo fund to accept donations. It's called the Matt Kenny Donation Fund, and contributions can be made at any Wells Fargo branch. A King Salmon man is in police custody for a murder case that is nearly 3 decades old. Authorities believe they will finally close a cold case that's haunted the community. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
An investigative team from the Lewis County Sheriff's Office in Washington State made an arrest in King Salmon on Sunday that they believe will put a close to a murder case that's been open since 1985. Rick Reif, aged 53, was arrested and is being processed for extradition back to Washington. Lewis County Sheriff Stephen Mansfield says it's about time.
Yesterday, our investigative team, along with the Alaska State Troopers, arrested Ricky Allen Reif in King Salmon, Alaska. Once the details are finalized, he's going to be transported back to Lewis County, where he's going to be booked in my jail. It's been a long and a tedious and frustrating cold case investigation, and the evidence is spanning over 26 years.
John Reif, Rick's brother, was also to be charged, but died on the 12th of June of apparent natural causes, just a week before deputies purchased their tickets to Alaska. Rick Reif will stand alone on charges of kidnapping and the brutal killings of an elderly couple, Ed and Minnie Morin, near Chehalis, Washington. A week before Christmas in 1985, family members notified authorities that the Morins, both in their 80s, were missing. Their car was found the next day, and 4 days later on Christmas Eve, the bodies of Ed and Minnie Morin were found by a passerby in a wooded area 7 miles from town. The investigation at the time revealed that the Morins had been kidnapped from their home, taken to a bank to withdraw more than $8,000, driven out of town, and shot inside their car with a shotgun. The bodies were left in the woods and the car driven back to town. Sheriff Mansfield said the Reif brothers have been the primary suspects this entire time.
We've known for over 2 decades, without a doubt, law enforcement here, that Rick and John Reif murdered the Marins. And the family has been patient with us. They've been supportive and they've been understanding of the hoops and the walls that we've had to crawl over, around, and go through.
For 26 years, detectives and a private investigator stayed on the case. The sheriff's office says the Reif brothers threatened witnesses early on, and many were wary of coming forward with information. Rick and John left Washington for Alaska in 1987, just 2 years after the murders, but investigators kept piecing together the evidence, and they never took their eyes off the Reif brothers.
For years, we've known where they are, where they're moving. They've been in some different places in Alaska. We keep tabs on them through intelligence that we have, and quite frankly, Alaska State Troopers have been nothing but helpful to us. They've just been a great professional organization to work with.
Sheriff Mansfield says the Marin family and the community have been waiting more than 26 years for justice in this horrific murder case.
You know, it's haunted the family, the sheriff's office, and this community for all these years, and it's a bittersweet moment.
John Reif died on June 12th. Rick Reif, who some have said has health problems of his own, was arrested on Sunday in King Salmon and is expected to be charged in Washington with 2 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of kidnapping in the first degree, 2 counts of robbery in the first degree, and burglary in the first degree. For KDLG, I'm Dave Benninger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage police consider expanding taser use.
In this last couple of 3 weeks, I have gotten the public's apparent acceptance of tasers. So that's been instructive for us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The beluga calf the Alaska Sea Life Center rescued from Naknek Bay has died. The cause of death is unknown, but experts say it's difficult to keep a newborn whale alive in captivity. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
The baby beluga rescued from Naknek Bay 3 weeks ago was having trouble processing food from the beginning. It was under 24-hour supervision by three rotating teams of three caregivers. Then yesterday evening, a team noticed he had an elevated heart rate. They brought in three additional experts to try to save the animal, but the calf died late last night. Despite the excitement surrounding the baby beluga's rescue, Tara Reamer Jones, president of the Alaska Sea Life Center, says they weren't surprised when the calf died.
The team that was actually working with the animal every day, while they were the closest to the animal, I think they also were the most realistic about its future. The rest of the staff, I think, probably took the news even harder because they wanted to believe so much that this was going to be successful. And it's just been very difficult when visitors have been coming in and asking, how's the beluga doing, to have to give them the truth this morning.
The beluga was only a few days old when it was found in Naknek on June 18th. Though belugas can survive for decades as adults in captivity, not much is known about keeping them alive as calves or just after birth. Jones says the team kept that in mind over the last 3 weeks.
We were trying to always be careful to say we were being cautiously optimistic. The truth is that the team was really surprised that the animal actually lived this long.
Jones says that the baby beluga found in Naknek 3 weeks ago was the first neonatal beluga to be rescued in the United States.
From the very beginning, every day was a win with this animal, and every day that we learned more about caring for a neonatal beluga was really a win for the team.
In the past 3 weeks, scientists and veterinarians have been visiting and calling to ask about the beluga. Jones says the center built a vast network of people willing to work on beluga neonatal care, and the team and scientists now know more about the whales during this stage in their lives.
We'll now have a better understanding of the intensity of what's required in these situations, what's required logistically to meet the demands of a neonatal beluga calf.
They will be conducting a necropsy this afternoon. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonathan.
A water treatment plant at the Tulsa-Quechief Mine Project in British Columbia has been shut down. Mine owners Chieftain Metals shut off the plant on June 22nd. The company says it cannot continue spending money on water treatment without any mine income. As KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports, acid rock drainage downstream of the mine has long been a concern of Alaskans, though a recent study shows metals concentration remains insignificant in some Taku River fish.
Cominco was the last company to mine the old Tulsa-Quechief, closing it in 1957. The mine was never properly shut down, and for 60 years, acidic water has been leaching into the Tulsaqua River. The Tulsaqua flows into the Taku River, considered Southeast Alaska's most abundant salmon producer. Canadian company Chieftain Metals Incorporated purchased the property 2 years ago from Redfern Resources. With it, Chieftain acquired Redfern's permits and the requirement that it would have to clean up the acid rock drainage. In December, the company started operating what's called an interim water treatment plant. Interim because
our permanent solution is the complete development of the mine.
That's Chieftain President and CEO Victor Wyprisky. When the mine is all played out, he says there will be no acidic drainage if it is properly shut down.
So it's all sealed up and there is no leakage.
Early in June, the company notified Environment Canada and BC Ministry of Environment of its plan to stop the water treatment for an unspecified period of time. Treatment plant costs had ballooned, and to date, the company has spent about $9 million on construction and operation. As Wyprisky puts it,
no company in the world will be sitting there treating water without a mine.
He likens it to paying a mortgage without the benefit of owning a house. In 60 years, Chieftain is the only company to attempt to treat the acid rock drainage from the Tulsaqua. Alaska Large Mine Coordinator Kyle Moselle says committing to and constructing a water treatment plant prior to mine development is unique.
The interim water treatment plant was constructed to address the legacy ARD, the acid rock drainage, from past mining. So that's really unique. And so they're not generating income or profit from development of the mine yet. I can't think of a situation that mirrors that we have here in Alaska.
With the shutdown of the treatment plant, Chieftain is now in violation of its environmental management permit from the BC government. But when the plant was operating, the discharge into the Tulsaqua River met permit water quality concentrations, according to Sentinel Dalal of the BC Ministry of Environment. Dalal says the government has required the company develop an action plan to get back into compliance. It's unclear how long that will take. The international conservation group Rivers Without Borders believes Chieftain's decision to shut down the water treatment plant indicates the Tulsaqua project is not financially feasible. Spokesman Chris Zimmer wants the state of Alaska to take the lead and work with U.S. and Canadian agencies in solving the acid drainage problem.
I'd like to see some cross-border cooperation to clean this up. I mean, this is the most productive salmon river in the region. There's a lot of jobs dependent on it. So what I'd like to see is Alaska step up and go to BC and say, all right, what are we going to do to clean this up? Because clearly we can't depend on the company.
6 months before Chieftain started the treatment plant, the state of Alaska collaborated with U.S. and Canadian scientists to measure the impact of acid rock drainage on Tulsaqua and Taku River water quality. It was the first metals testing on the U.S. side of the Taku River. Fish and game biologist Joe Hitzelberger says they captured juvenile Dolly Varden at two sites on the Tulsaqua and one on the Taku, but Hitzelberger says they did not find high metals concentrations in the fish.
For the metals that we looked at, the values we got were lower than what we see at other sites in Southeast and lower than the EPA criteria.
It was a small study, and Hitzelberger says it would be good to gather years of data like Fish and Game has from other Alaska mining sites, but he says the results don't indicate a need to immediately keep testing. Meanwhile, the multi-metal Tulsaqua mine is about 4 years from opening. Chieftain CEO Ry Prisky says the feasibility study continues to show a viable project. He says it's a matter of fine-tuning the economics so it's more attractive to investors. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
A public meeting is planned for later this month about recent police shootings in Anchorage. Polynesian community members say they are satisfied with a preliminary meeting over the shootings Friday. On Saturday, they held a rally to draw attention to their cause. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Officials say around 150 people turned out at Far North Bicentennial Park over the weekend to call on the Anchorage Police Department to consider changing their policies around shooting. Miriama Amave, the executive director of the newly formed Polynesian Community Center, helped organize the event.
And it wasn't just the Polynesian community, it was a very diverse group. We really demonstrated that we were coming together as a voice, like there is an issue and we were trying to raise that. And it was really peaceful, you know, like it was nothing violent, like they were stating that it was going, you know, that they were afraid of.
About a dozen people attended a private meeting on Friday preceding the rally, including representatives of the mayor's office, Anchorage Police Chief Mark Mew, and members of Polynesian community groups, among others. Officials did not go into detail about what was discussed, but Amave says the meeting was productive.
It was just a starting point for communication between the community and Anchorage Police Department.
June 9th, an Anchorage police officer shot and killed a Samoan man, Shane Tossey, who was brandishing a stick in the Mountain View neighborhood. Chief Mew says the Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals, a division of the State Attorney General's office, ruled the shooting was legal because the officer believed he and a bystander were faced with imminent threat of serious physical injury or death. Another man holding a BB gun resembling a real Smith & Wesson gun was shot and killed during a police call July 1st. Amave's group and others who attended the rally are calling on the APD to consider using non-lethal force, a proposition that Police Chief Mark Mew says is difficult.
We can't have a lot of bullets flying around.
frankly, getting center mass hits on a fast-moving target is difficult enough. Trying to shoot hands and feet and knives and guns would be almost impossible to do.
Chief Mew says since the recent shootings, his office has been flooded with requests to equip more officers with tasers, something he's willing to consider.
In this last couple, 3 weeks, I have gotten the public's apparent acceptance of tasers. So that's been instructive for us. And if the public has an appetite for more of that technology and is willing to fund it, then I certainly will take a look at what we can do in that regard.
But Mew says issuing more tasers will have a hefty price tag. Each one will cost approximately $1,300, and there'll be additional costs in the form of training and related equipment. Right now, about half of the force carries tasers. Three people have been shot by APD officers this year, two fatally. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A well-respected chief from Eagle Village was killed in a car accident in Anchorage last week. 71-year-old Isaac Junabee was a charismatic man known for his humor and smile. Junabee was one of the last Han language speakers. He recently began a master's degree focusing on Han regalia. His wife Sandy says he did not start speaking English until the age of 9. As a child, she says he wore the traditional clothing of the Han Athabascan tribe.
Isaac has written 2 books and tapes on the Han language, so it wouldn't be lost. It's really kind of a sad thing because it's gone. And he was so absolutely adamant about the fact that it had to survive. That's what he was doing his master's degree on. He was doing it on the preservation of the language, the land, and the people.
Junabee served in the Army, worked for the National Park Service, and was heavily involved in Eagle's Historical Society. Eagle locals say his nickname, Ike, can still be found etched into the railing of an old gold mine dredging near Slavin's Cabin on the Yukon River. As chief of Eagle Village, Sandy Junabee says her late husband worked to achieve sobriety and to preserve traditional ways of life.
He was an incredibly wonderful man who dreamt just wonderful dreams for these people, that they would heal and that they would be whole, and that he came to help them. He wanted so much to be a help. After he got sober, that was the thing that I think drove him.
Isaac Junabee was the youngest first chief of Eagle Village. Sandy Junabee says he was well respected by the village elders. He went by the nickname Senator because of his love for politics. Isaac Junabee was in Anchorage when he was killed to be with his sister, Ellen Florence Junabee Rada, who died Sunday afternoon at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. She was taken off life support a week ago after being severely beaten in Fairbanks. Fairbanks police have ruled her death a homicide and arrested a suspect, 57-year-old Rick Allen, on a charge of second-degree murder. A memorial service was held in Fairbanks for Isaac Junabee earlier today. Junabee's body will be driven to Eagle Village on Tuesday. The caravan will stop in Dot Lake and Tanacross along the way. Junabee will be buried alongside other members of his family on Wednesday. The annual Creative Writing Talks at the University of Alaska Anchorage this week kicked off with a celebrity guest, California poet Gary Snyder. His reading at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium drew a large crowd last night. APRN Steve Heimel sat down for a visit with the poet before the reading.
At age 82, Gary Snyder has no trouble making himself at home, sitting down on the ground with me at a dog park behind his hotel on campus. A dog is his companion now on the 100 acres he owns in the mountains outside Nevada City, California, and he figures next time he comes back here, he'll bring his standard poodle. Snyder, a poet of place, has visited Alaska a number of times in the past.
You know, this is north of the extent of the range of Douglas fir. Sometimes I think of my range as going as far north as Doug fir. But, you know, on the other hand, since I'm an old climber, I go all the way to the timberline, and the timberline is up in the Brooks Range. I've been around in Alaska enough to be pretty much at home here.
Snyder's a very easy guy to talk with, so long as the subject is nature and not art. His work has been very inspirational to the environmental movement, but he says when he works on the poems, he's not looking to get that sort of message across. Rather, what he's working with is the language and its associations.
Cultural and archetypal images, very ancient Occidental images, still deep in our minds, including the dualistic quality of our thinking, that is as much of a challenge as anything about the place.
In his essays, Snyder has laughed at himself for fighting forest fires in his youth, not realizing that without fire, the forest grew unhealthy. He's much more ready to talk about what he's not than what he is. For instance, he doesn't consider himself a Beat Generation poet, though that's how he's invariably described. In fact, Snyder figures prominently in a Jack Kerouac novel as a poet who wants to write a poem that goes on for many years on a very long scroll. And in fact, Snyder did write such a poem, Mountains and Rivers Without End, finishing it in the 1990s.
You can say that I'm an artist, and I will say, yeah, I'm an artist, but I'm not a graphic artist. I'm not even a storyteller. I'm not trying to speak for the land. I'm trying to speak for something else.
For 60 years, he's been deep in Buddhist studies, responsible, in fact, for much of the Beat Generation's fascination with Zen. He lived in Japan for 9 years, and he's a capable translator. But as far as explaining his own poems, I'm not the first interviewer to discover that Gary Snyder just won't.
You know, what I do is I write poems. I don't answer questions about my poems. I expect people to read them, and if they have some questions about what they've read, I can answer those. But I can't tell you more of what I do or what I would propose to do than what I've already done. It stands there, ready for anybody to make use of it.
The MFA program readings continue nightly with Nancy Lord, Linda McCarriston, Joanne Mapson, Craig Childs, and others through this week and into next. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We've had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Emily Schwing in Eagle. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.